Hanging in the West Gallery of the Frick Collection in New York is a painting by Claude Lorraine. It's a very large canvas. It's about 5.5 by 9 feet. And it depicts the Sermon on the Mount. Now, this is an amazingly detailed painting. It's a great example of a pastoral genre. It's luminous, and it's arresting. At the center of the painting is Jesus sitting atop Mount Tabor, teaching the disciples who are arrayed around him. And then there are groups of people sprinkled out down the hill and on the plain in front of the mount. Lorraine uses perspective masterfully here. Our eyes are drawn to Jesus at the top of the mountain, but we follow the line of people coming down to the bottom of the canvas, each group getting larger until we come to the bottommost group, and we feel that we're the next. The painting is designed to draw us in, to make us feel as if we were there when Jesus was preaching to the disciples and the crowd. I've seen this painting many times, and I had occasion to see it again this past week. And as is the case with much art, repeated viewings turn up new details, things I've not noticed before. And this past week, I found my attention seized by people in the crowd. You never really noticed their posture, their position, what they were doing. And there were a number of them throughout who were raising up their hands and looking to Jesus and God in awe. This was very striking because I had today's reading for Matthew in mind as I looked at this painting. My first reaction was, I cannot imagine that Jesus just said these words to elicit this reaction. Oh, sure, maybe they would be excited and enthusiastic when they heard the Beatitudes, that vision of what the kingdom of God is all about. Or maybe even last week's lesson, in which the church, the community of God, is called to be a light unto the nations. But this reading? These words? This is where the hard work starts. Jesus is all business here. There's nothing soft and cuddly in this reading, is there? What are we to make of this? How are we to understand what is going on in this incredibly challenging text? The key is in last week's reading. Remember, we heard Jesus declare that he had come not to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. And now he is talking about how that is done. 4 times he tells us, back in olden days, you heard things were supposed to be done a certain way. Now Jesus says, this is how we're going to do it today. He starts off with these very extreme positions. Murder. You've heard how if you commit murder, you're going to be judged. Well, guess what? If you're angry with someone, if you're holding a grudge, resentment, if you need to apologize to someone, go and engage in reconciliation right now. If you don't, you're going to be judged. You heard it said in all the times, if you commit adultery, you'll be punished. Well, guess what? If you even have an adulterous thought, Jesus says, pluck out your eye, cut off your hand. It's getting a little extreme here. Then he talks about divorce. In olden days, you were supposed to have the right paperwork. Now, don't divorce. And finally, In the past, you were told if you made an oath, you needed to follow through. But now, don't make an oath. Why the extremes? What is Jesus asking us to do here? Is he setting us up to fail? Jesus knew, looking out at that crowd of people, looking at his disciples, he didn't have a group of would-be murderers in his midst. But what about people who might be angry? What about people who might think they have been wronged and are waiting for an apology? What about people who have done something wrong and need to extend an apology? That is something the crowd could relate to. There may not have been a sea of adulterers there, but people look at other people. People could relate to that. Again, divorce. A challenging one for us to hear. We have very different notions of this today. But Jesus lived in a different world. And he knew how easy it was for men in that day and age to end a marriage. If you listen to the language, you'll notice it's gender specific here. There's the man who got to call things off. Here we start to see, in ways we can begin to understand, Jesus turning some norms upside down. And finally, the oaths. It's not something that we dwell on much. We don't take oaths as seriously today as people did back then. Sure, you might go to court, maybe take office, and you can take an oath with your hand on the Bible, but that's become optional. But back in Jesus' day, using the name of God was serious business. All four of these situations have something in common. The new way Jesus is calling us to live involves not just focusing on our actions, but also on our motives and our thinking and our feeling and on our perspective. Think about that first admonition about murder and reconciliation. Jesus is telling people, there in Galilee, if you've gone all the way down to Jerusalem, traveled a couple of days, gone great expense, great trouble, courted danger, got into the temple, and realized you had some unfinished business with someone about mending a relationship, you should turn around and go home. That sounds like a pretty serious demand. Why would Jesus say that? Perhaps because Jesus knows that we only have so much room in our hearts and our minds and our souls. And if we're filling ourselves up with anger and resentment and frustration, with self-righteousness and indignation, where's the room for God? And what's the point of going to the temple or coming to church if we want to nurse our grudges? The same thing with the adultery and with the divorce and with the oaths. How we handle situations, how we relate to one another, how we feel and think determines whether we've got room for God in our lives. And so Jesus calls on us to set these things aside. Now, it's easy enough to stand up here and say, we should do this, that I should do this. But in real life, it's hard, isn't it? We can be hurt. We can be right that we've been hurt. When I find myself going down that road, I try to remember my late friend Dick Nethercutt. I may have talked about Dick before, but for those of you who have not heard of him, Dick was a member of my old church back in Concord, Massachusetts. And he was a lovely man. He was a retired Foreign Service officer. In 1979, Dick's daughter was raped and murdered in Seattle. And in the wake of this event, Dick felt great anger and fury. Not surprising. But he found that he was being consumed by hate. And it was taking him over. And Dick realized that this was not the road he wanted to travel down with his life. It wasn't going to bring Jaina back. It wasn't going to heal the hole in his heart. And so he did something remarkable. He forgave his daughter's killer. Did not absolve him of the act, but he extended forgiveness. And in that moment, Dick was able to free himself. And from there, he began to work in prisons and participated in efforts of restorative justice, which are focused on trying to make whole the broken situations. Now, Dick did this work for many, many years. He's justly known throughout Massachusetts for all of his efforts. In 2009, in mid-September, Dick disappeared. And at first, people thought, well, maybe Dick's gone off and taken a trip. But 8 days after he was last seen, his car was found. And immediately, people began to express their fears. Had one of the people that Dick had helped taken advantage of him? Had he been on a fool's errand all of these years? Had his good work come back to bite him? We held a prayer vigil at the church. About 150 people came. There have been offenders, people who work in prisons, law enforcement, members of the community. We just prayed for a sense of peace in that moment, trying to focus on who Dick was and what Dick was all about. We prayed for his safe return. Well, days turned into weeks. There was a huge dragnet. No sign of Dick. And then in mid-October, a couple of citizens decided they were going to do some searching too. And they found Dick's body in conservation land, a couple of towns over from Concord. Police investigated, and they said there was no sign of foul play. Dick, at 83, had a heart attack while he was out walking in the woods, something he loved to do. It was time for the memorial service. And the church was packed. Hundreds and hundreds of people came together, witnessing to what Dick meant to them. There were ex-cons there. There were prison officials, politicians, members of the church. And one by one, people talked about how Dick, through his work and his example, had shown them that there was a different way to live life. What Dick did was bring Jesus' message about the kingdom of heaven to life. We talked about the Beatitudes being not focused on some future event, but about the reality of God's kingdom here and now, this day. We may not always see it, but it is there. And it was present in Dick's work. And the instinct of this world to say, no, it's not, was there where people fear the worst. Through Dick's life, hundreds and hundreds of people found their own lives transformed. That's what the kingdom of God is about. Which brings us back to Claude Lorrain's painting. And those people who are looking up to the heavens with enthusiasm and excitement. And in further reflection, I think maybe they have just heard these words. Matthew will end the Sermon on the Mount telling us that the people responded with amazement that Jesus taught with authority. And perhaps that authority was recognized because Jesus came not to tell the people, not to tell you and me what we want to hear, but what we need to hear. And the things we need to hear are those things that are going to allow us to be disciples and to enter fully into the kingdom of God. So we can imagine ourselves there at Mount Tabor, at the foot of the mountain, in the crowd, with those people, listening to Jesus. And perhaps we will be touched too, wanting to look up to God and offer our praise for giving us the hard work to do and for helping us to see it for the blessing it is.